from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, John Lithgow, known for his starring role in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun and his turn as Winston Churchill in Netflix's The Crown, has written a book of poems satirizing the Trump era called Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse. Lithgow says the book made him overcome his hesitation about going political in a public way. Join our conversation with John Lithgow after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. John Lithgow has played many political figures on stage and screen, from Winston Churchill to Bill Clinton to voicing James Roosevelt in the Ken Burns documentary On the Family. Now he has a book satirizing this political moment, in verse, no less. Lithgow is known for his starring role in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun and films The World According to Garp, Terms of Endearment, which earned him Oscar nominations, also Harry and the Hendersons, Shrek, Love is Strange, and so many more. He'll also play Fox News CEO Roger Ailes in the upcoming film Bombshell. Welcome to Forum, John Lithgow.
I feel very welcome, Mina. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're very glad to have you here. And if you wouldn't mind starting off by reading from your book, this is your book, Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse. And I'll let you pick, but also I'd love if you wouldn't mind also doing a little bit from the poem that you wrote about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, because as I understand it, that was kind of the poem or performance that started it all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hadn't plotted any poem to start with, but maybe that's the best one. And that will help us start with how this all began, because it was one of the very first bright ideas I had. It's called An Ex-Lieutenant General, after Gilbert and Sullivan. And it's written as a poem, but it's a riff on a song. So I'll sing it. Why not start with singing?
Why not?
Okay. I am the very model of an ex-lieutenant general, although my reputation is decidedly ephemeral. In spite of all my service in remote Afghanistanafore, no officer has screwed the pooch as much as Michael Flynnafore. When President Obama made me head of all things clandestine, he realized he'd brought to life a governmental Frankenstein. But then I made a killing in a case of public pillory by shouting, "Lock her up!" in my harangue opposing Hillary. So Dumpty made me National Security Advisory, until I let the crafty Russian Secret Service hire me. Then I became the target of a special counsel crime report, a fate I share with Cohen Donald Jr. and with Manafort. I plead the Fifth Amendment when the arbiters of law attack my meeting Jared Kushner in a room with Sergei Kislyak. Although my reputation is decidedly ephemeral, I am the very model of an ex-lieutenant general. That's my
John Lithgow from his book Dumpty.
You didn't expect to hear a song.
I did not. And it was so wonderful. Thank you for doing it in song for us. Gilbert and Sullivan, no less. And that is Gilbert and Sullivan. They have really played a big part in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did. Yeah, I guess in college, I spent a summer. Well, I appeared in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta called Utopia Limited at Harvard, which was, I think somebody dropped out and they immediately called upon me. I was my sophomore year and I was already a kind of campus theater fixture. So they persuaded me to play this leading role in a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, King Paramount in Utopia Limited. And it was the first time I'd ever sung on stage. And I had a huge success with it and ended up spending the following summer at a light opera, a summer stock festival, where I played another five or six roles in Gilbert and Sullivan. And haven't done it since, but it was I guess it certainly emboldened me as an actor. It's something I never knew I could do.
Yes, I mean, that's interesting because it's as if even though you were an actor in a way, because I understand your dad put on Shakespeare plays, he ran a local theater or traveling theater.
Yes, he was a... It wasn't just local theaters. It was major classical repertory companies in Ohio. He did a series of four summer Shakespeare festivals, which was actually the same festival, but just in different forms. The last of them was the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival, which has survived as the Great Lakes Theater Festival in Cleveland. So I grew up awash in Shakespeare, I and my siblings. We were in the plays. We would hang around and watch rehearsals for the plays, starting when we were 6 and 7 years old. It was mother's milk to me, Shakespeare. In fact, I was in 20 Shakespeare plays before I was 20 years old. I didn't grow up intending to be an actor. It was the family business, and I didn't want to go into it. I wanted to be an artist. But by the time I arrived in college, I just fell in with the theater group, and I was already an accomplished actor in spite of myself. So I sort of went with the flow. I realized this was my destiny, whether I wanted it to be or not.
Yes, an artist. You know, the listeners might be surprised to know that the painting of Trump's face and the cover, all the illustrations in your book, you did.
That's right. It's for the first time I've illustrated anything. Although I've continued to do art, I feel presumptuous even calling it art out of respect to genuine artists. But I've always done family Christmas cards and caricatures for opening nights of Broadway shows or wrap gifts on movies when the shooting comes to an end. It's just something I do to amuse myself. There are periods of time when I have acquired a studio and spent a summer painting, and I always nurse that fantasy of just giving up acting and just become a painter from the last chapter of my life. But I'll never do that.
Well, why was it hard for you to kind of lay bare your political views, especially about Trump, in this particular book? It's something that you hesitated to do before, you've said.
Yes, I can only explain my reticence by saying that I've always felt there was a very strict, almost a rule for myself to keep the private John quite separate and almost anonymous from my public entertainer John. Just because, you know, you're entertaining all sorts of people, and I immerse myself in roles. When I act, I want them to just respond to that character, not to who's behind it. It's ridiculous to be so rigid about such a thing. And it may also have something to do with my innate spinelessness politically, although I have my serious politics. I just never thought I should go public with it. I'm an articulate enough fellow, but as soon as I'm involved in a political argument, I develop a speech impediment. I can barely express myself. Maybe it's fear of confrontation and conflict or whatever, but like I would never dream of being on Bill Maher's show and mixing it up with conservatives. And yet, God knows, I have my passionate feelings about it.
Well, speaking of immersing yourself in roles and about politics, I do want to just play a little bit of how you portrayed Winston Churchill in the Netflix series The Crown. And in this scene, you're meeting a new employee and you're in the bathtub with a drink and a cigar, and she's talking to you through the bathroom door.
I remember it well.
Have they told you terrible things? Your colleagues downstairs?
Go on, be candid.
It is said you can be difficult.
I can be a monster. Did they say that?
Yes, sir.
It's true. But you need to be a monster to defeat Hitler.
That's my guest, John Lithgow, playing Winston Churchill. Playing Winston Churchill, does it give you insight into what it means to be a politician, to be a political leader under such stressful times?
I don't know. I certainly learned a lot. It was like an extraordinary history lesson, playing the part, researching the part, learning all sorts of things. I thought I knew a lot about Churchill. I'd played Franklin Roosevelt once in a drama about Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin during their diplomatic interactions during the war. But as soon as I started working on the role and learning about him, I realized how much I didn't know. He was an extraordinary man. One of the nice things about an acting profession, if you're lucky, is you learn all sorts of extraordinary things when you prepare a role. I mean, I've played a butcher before. I've played a painter. I've played all manner of roles, including historical figures. I learned how to cut meat when I was a butcher. That's almost a metaphor for what I learned about Churchill and Roger Ailes and Fox News.
Well, what surprised you most about Churchill as you were learning more about
him? His insecurities, his childhood. I was so amazed at the first 25, 30 years of his life, how they formed him. You know, this was a boy who grew up with such a sense of his own failure. And he was very neglected. He was all virtually ignored. And it was clear he was not going to be an achiever. So he was, in a sense, dispensed with. He didn't go to Oxford and Cambridge. He went to Sandhurst, the military academy, a military training in the early years, not unlike our current president. You know, it's like and from there, he just simply spent a life of overcompensation, I feel.
Huh.
He would expose himself to extraordinary dangers. He was in four or five life-threatening wartime situations by the time he was 25 years old, 30 years old, in Cuba, Sudan, South Africa, Afghanistan. He was not technically in the military, but he would thrust himself into military situations posing as a journalist. He just wanted to make a name for himself because he grew up with this sense of failure.
Did playing him give you any insight into President Trump's behavior? I mean, you did draw a slight parallel, not that they're necessarily on the same plane, but...
You know, it's an interesting thing. I was being interviewed by The Guardian during the election. And I was playing Winston Churchill at the time, and I did draw a parallel between Churchill and Trump and their faces, their jaw. You've never seen jaws drop so quickly. I would say there was a boldness about Churchill. There's a kind of unedited political id about him. He would just say what he meant, and he knew what he meant. And he was fierce and assertive about it. In a sense, that's Trumpian. The difference, of course, is Winston was an extraordinarily intelligent and strategic man. He also knew exactly what Britain needed in a moment of terrible crisis. But it got him into terrible trouble, as it has gotten Trump into terrible trouble. I mean, you look at Churchill's lifetime and career, and it looks like a parabolic graph of ups and downs. You know, he was voted out of office after being the hero of World War II, immediately after, and it was devastating to him. Well, that had happened to him five or six times in his political life. I wasn't quite aware of that crazy, bumpy roller coaster ride before I started working on him, nor was I aware of what a voice in the wilderness he was during the era of appeasement in the 1930s, that 90% of Britain wanted to appease Hitler. And he really was crying out, saying, "We cannot accommodate this man. Look at what he's doing."
Has playing Roger Ailes given you any insight into Trump's behavior as well? I mean, Roger Ailes, the CEO, the former CEO of Fox News, who was accused by Gretchen Carlson of sexual harassment, and then Megyn Kelly revealed his unwanted sexual advances, and then several other women came out against him. And ultimately he resigned, but then he joined and became an advisor to the Donald Trump campaign. So playing him, I mean, first, how do you play someone like that?
Well, I mean, to answer your first question, it's an extraordinary film, this Bombshell.
It comes out in December, is that?
Yes, I'm not here to promote it, but let me promote it. it's an amazing and unusual film in the vein of All the President's Men or Spotlight. And the age of Trump sort of hangs over it. It records the fall of Roger Ailes at the very moment when Trump is on the precipitous rise. He Ailes is out just as Trump wins the nomination, and it sort of tells the story of that up and down fortunes of these two men. There are certain parallels. The movie doesn't lean too hard on them, nor do I. As for playing the part, there again, I went for the heart of the matter, which is Roger Ailes' insecurity and his compulsions and his kind of anguished needs. I consider him a very sad character. He's portrayed by the conventional wisdom, by media, and everyone's perception of him is just a dark villain of the piece. But you can't approach a character in only those terms if you're playing the part. The most interesting and revealing thing I found researching him, just in the way I learned so much about Churchill's childhood, I sought out a friend of mine who had been his business associate and producing partner in the 1970s when he wanted to be a theater producer, and he was just starting his career in political consultancy. And this friend of mine, a man named Steve, I tracked him down after many, many years and just asked him to talk to me about Roger Ailes. And he told me a version which nobody has told me, that he was fabulous company, that he had a roaring, boisterous sense of humor, and he was very edgy, that he could be very hard on his own conservative political candidates, his clients, for being too right-wing and not having enough empathy. These are qualities of Ailes which I'd never heard before. I couldn't wait to rush to the set and discuss them with our writer Charles Randolph and our director Jay Roach, because it just gives a different dimension. I mean, there was something about this man which made a lot of people devoted to him very genuinely love him. One of the great assets in playing the part was Connie Britton playing my wife, Beth Ailes. She genuinely loved him. And that just makes him something more than just a villain. It's as in any drama, the more complex and contradictory a character is, the more compelling.
Yes, though, are you ever conflicted around that? And I guess the only reason I ask is because we do live in a system which feels like it affords certain characters much more dimension, often much more than the victims themselves.
Mm-hmm. I just think there are many sides to every story. The unique thing about the film is there is a vast cast, and you get to know about 10 or 12 characters very well, almost like a Robert Altman film. You track their separate storylines, how they respond to a crisis and to a malevolent force, which was unquestionably Roger Ailes and the culture that he created around Fox. But you see so many dimensions to each of these women. I mean, some of them fiercely defended Roger and insisted everybody wear a Defend Roger T-shirt around the studios. And the other extreme is women who were destroyed by Roger and have tried to survive outside of Fox. And the three major storylines in roles played by Charlize Theron, Nicole Kidman, and Margot Robbie. Those are interacting stories. You see three extremely different responses to the situation.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the trailer of Bombshell. And this is a scene where you're talking to the character played by Margot Robbie, and she speaks first.
I want to convince you that I belong on air, Mr. Ailes. I think I'd be freaking phenomenal on your network.
I could pluck you out and move you to the front of the line, but I need to know that you're loyal. I need you to find a way to prove it.
I gotta say, you also look pretty darn scary in this.
I'm very scary.
See, you've got major jowls. I know to bring out Ailes, and I think you're also wearing a suit to put a lot of pounds on you there.
Yeah, I look like a 300-pound walrus. And I was delighted with how I looked.
Really captured it all. We're talking with stage and screen actor and writer John Lithgow. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. As you know, he is known for so many films and also sitcoms, Third Rock from the Sun. He played Arthur Mitchell in Dexter. And we talked earlier about him playing Winston Churchill in The Crown. But so many films, from The World According to Garp to Terms of Endearment to Shrek to Love is Strange. And if you'd like to ask questions of John Lithgow or tell us what performance stands out to you, call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your questions or comments on Facebook, on Twitter. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post thoughts on our website. And Pete tweets us. He says, I've enjoyed John's work since he came out as Roberta Muldoon. Would he comment on the damage Fox News has done to our democracy and its formulaic manipulation of viewers? So did you learn a lot about that aspect of it, doing this film?
Well, as if we didn't already know that.
Yes, but still, like,
yeah,
just
the inner
workings.
Yeah, I learned a lot about it. It is amazing. And as things, as stakes get higher and the temperature rises with the current, you know, what's happening today in current politics – I think you're seeing just in greater and greater relief just how what a dark force Fox News is. It's like a state news agency more now all the time. I mean, it could be argued that it would not be quite as black and white and quite as strident if Ailes were still around. I mean, that's a radical thing to say, but on the basis of what I've learned, you know, he did have a side to him, which was very tough on fanatical extremism.
Well, let's hear more radical things from John Lithgow after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with multi-Emmy Award-winning actor, two-time Oscar nominee, and Tony Award-winning theater great John Lithgow. He's written more than 30 poems satirizing the critical moments and characters of the Trump era in a new book that he wrote and illustrated titled Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse. And you probably know him from his wide-ranging stage and film roles. And this listener writes... this man is a national treasure. This is Andy. He says, in addition to top-tier acting in Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse, Lithgow turns a thought and word into a wonderful read. Let's go next to James in Albany. Hi, James.
Hi there.
Hi. What would you like to say?
I love John Lithgow because he does so many different kinds of acting, including, you know, serial killer to comedian. Not to mention amazing banjo player. I would like to see more of John playing banjo, but my favorite role has been a serial killing priest in Dexter, because that role kind of adds up all of his complex myself calming to killer in one role. I love you.
Oh, God.
Well, James, thanks.
Thanks for that. I just grew an inch taller, James. I have to correct you on one important thing, though. I am not a great banjo player. I once played the banjo on a Discover Card commercial as best I could. But they looped in, they dubbed in, they post-dubbed Tony Triska or Bella Flex, some great banjo player, and everybody thinks I'm this maestro. I haven't even touched my banjo in about 8 years because I'm not good enough.
Well, you're so multi-talented, then the assumption is, of course, just throw in the banjo, too. Of course he's good at that.
I shouldn't disabuse you, but it would be truth in advertising.
Well, James, thanks. This listener writes, your career has such range from slapstick humor to drama, and you embody your character so well. Even the Progresso soup commercial, your voice gets a full dramatic treatment. How do you choose the projects you take on, this listener wants to know.
Well, there's a lot less choice involved than you would think, because good things don't come along that often. Bad things come in droves. But I say yes much more than I should, probably. At the moment, I'm working my head off. I've got so many things going. Something about growing old.
Makes you want to do more things, you mean?
No, it's not that it makes me want to do more things. It's just that I seem to be more sought after. There aren't quite as many old actors around. My competition has either quit or died off. So I don't know. It's when a good thing comes up, I just do it if I possibly can.
Well, speaking about a good thing, you've talked a lot about just the great experience of being on Third Rock from the Sun. And given the last comment that we had about just the full dramatic treatment, I do feel like in that role that you played, and the name of your character escapes me.
Dick Solomon.
That's right. Dick Solomon.
The High Commander.
It felt like you were able to really put a lot of yourself into that role. And let's just hear a scene from it quickly.
Okay.
This is one where you're in a restaurant, and of course you're an alien from another planet, and you have this whole notion of tipping.
Oh, great.
Hello. Would you like something from the bar?
Yes, I'll have a glass of Merlot and a Chardonnay for the lady who will be joining me. Oh, and can we establish something first? You are, I assume, expecting a tip?
Well, yes.
Yeah, all right. Now, this pile of $1 bills represents your potential tip. Every time you please me, you'll see the pile grow. However, if I am unsatisfied, if you're slow, mouthy, or sneeze into your hands, you'll notice the pile shrinking. Agreed?
Yes, I guess.
All right. Good luck.
This is great. That will remain the most entertaining part of this interview.
Well, the laugh track. Wow, that really brings me back.
That was no laugh track. That was a happy, happy studio audience.
Yes, they do it in front of a studio audience.
Yeah,
is it a lot like theater?
It is more theater than film by a long shot. No, that was what was ecstatically fun about Third Rock from the Sun, is preparing a 25-minute-long farce in the course of about 4 days, once a week, 22 times a year. It was so much fun. And I've worked on other sitcoms, which I will not name, where there was no studio audience, and yet there was laughter dubbed in afterwards. And I watched those shows afterwards, and I think, something's wrong here. There's laughter at jokes that just aren't that funny. Well, by God, ours were authentically hilarious. And there would be moments of 15 seconds of laughter that was so spontaneous and electric. And it's something you only get in theater, because that's what we were doing. We were doing theater, and the cast was a bunch of theater artists who were really, really good at it.
You know, that makes sense now, because I was watching some of the shows in doing research for this interview. There really is a kind of relationship with that live studio audience and the timing of things based on when they're laughing. And
oh, my God. We blindsided them with the jokes, and you can hear sometimes they would simply explode, and we would just hold and hold and hold for the laughter to the point where they had to cut away in the edit. It took up too much time.
Is that part of why you continue to do theater every few years? I mean, mm-hmm. it feels like, I mean, you just recently did one Hillary and Clinton with Laurie Metcalf.
Yes, on Broadway.
Where you played Bill Clinton.
Yeah, yeah. I've been playing all sorts of political titans in the last few years.
Everybody tells me that doing theater keeps them really sharp.
Yeah, I mean, I've told you, I grew up in the theater, and to me, it's the kind of taproot of just about everything I do. I mean, to the extent that I'm special in movies or even TV drama, I think it's what I bring from theater. I am a theatrical performer sometimes to excess. I wish I had a nickel for every time a director has told me to take it down a bit on this next take. You know, in fact, it's a kind of compact I make with every director that I'll go full out and it's up to you to dial me down. Otherwise, they won't get any of the good stuff, you know, when they're in the edit room. And I'm sort of known for it. I'm known to be a sort of demon of excess, you know, and I'm happy with that. I did this movie that I'm so delighted that you have mentioned it twice, a small film called Love is Strange a few years ago, where I was paired with Alfred Molina, an actor I just adore, and I adored working with him. And we were directed by the filmmaker Ira Sachs. And Ira's whole technique is no acting. In fact, he said that so many times. It was, okay, this time, no acting or less acting. And both Fred and I had the experience on separate shooting days of hearing that for the first time and being very miffed. No acting? Well, what do you think I do? And yet, going on his trip, going on his journey with him, taking his advice and taking out all the acting. And Fred and I did some of the best acting we've ever done. You'll see that film and it's got such a calmness and simplicity and tranquil center. And it's extremely moving. And it was there I was at about age 70 getting an extraordinary acting lesson.
Mm. Well, let me go next to our callers. Ellen in Berkeley, join us. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I just wanted to say, John, that I loved your portrayal of Trump in the live reading of the Mueller report that happened in New York City this year. I'd love to know how you prepared for that role. And I'd also love to hear another poem from your book.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll give you an answer and then I'll give you a poem. The live streaming, it was a live streaming. We did something I've never done before, live streaming on YouTube, I think. It was a 1 hour and 10 minute play, which was put together by Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Edward Schenken, which took part two of the Mueller report, the part that dealt with obstruction of justice, and abridged it down to an hour and 10 minutes, but every word of it was verbatim, and almost all of it, amazingly enough, was dialogue. I mean, the Mueller report is full of reconstructed dialogue. Certainly, I mean, if you think of the famous transcriptions of conversations that we've all read about, they're all in that 1 hour long play. And I guess I was asked to do it about 8 or 9 days beforehand. I was told to pick my role. I thought, well, I bet Trump is a good role. And they gathered together all these actors who were in New York at the time and ready to do it. Practically everyone said yes. So it was me, Kevin Kline as Bob Mueller. Annette Bening was a wonderful narrator. Jason Alexander was Chris Christie. Michael Shannon was Donald McCann. Who else? Alfre Woodard, Edie Sedgwick, Noah Emmerich, Aidan Quinn. Just this amazing bunch of actors. They all said yes. We all gathered at 6 p.m. and read it through once. And then we performed it live, I believe, at 8 p.m. with the cameras rolling. It was directed by Scott Ellis, very to the extent that it was directed. He's a very, very good Broadway theater director. Put it together just effortlessly, and we just let it rip. We were reading it. We didn't have to memorize a single word. And in terms of characterization, none of us did a blow-by-blow imitation except for Joel Grey as Jeff Sessions, who was a sensational Jeff Sessions. I simply played Trump's id, which is basically how Trump plays Trump.
And did you want to read a poem for Ellen?
Yes, yes.
But and while you're choosing that, I mean, why choose to do this satire in verse? And why Dumpty, besides the fact that it sort of sounds like Trump? But is there some parallel with the Humpty Dumpty nursery rhyme?
Well, of course. There are a series of four Humpty Dumpty,
right.
Trumpty Dumpty poems that they turn up all through the sequence of poems. There are also three rub-a-dub-dub poems. A lot of them are riffs on Lewis Carroll, Edward Lear, John Masefield, I Must Go Down to the Sea Again, to the Lonely Sea in the Sun. I've got a flotilla of 10 big yachts, and I'll pick my favorite one. That's Betsy DeVos, of course. We started off with Michael T. Flynn as the ex-lieutenant general. In fact, I've told this story so many times, many of your listeners have heard it. But in fact, that was the germ that sprouted into this book. I was asked to perform at a New York Public Theater gala to play the major general and to sing that song. And I did it as Michael Flynn, and I rewrote the third verse. And that third verse is the first poem of the book. If I hadn't done that, this book would never have even occurred to me. And even at that, it was the idea of my literary agent, not mine. I sang him that song, and he said, "You've got a book there. I could sell that tomorrow morning. Write poems about the extraordinary cast of characters of the Trump administration. There's such bizarre, hilarious, comic, almost farce characters." The idea just seemed completely natural to me. I have had, over the years, I've written light verse, doggerel verse, most notably in my 9 children's books, which I have to send you for your children. And I have written, I gave 2 commencement addresses to prep schools with small graduating senior classes, and I incorporated the names of all the graduating alumni, surprising them on stage as I – I've done these entertainments in verse. So it came very naturally. It was hard work, but the subjects were so delicious. I just made a database of about 30 characters and events, and the rhymes came – well, not easily, but reliably. So that's the Major General song. I was requested to read another. I don't know what length we should use. We only have this hour.
That's true.
Mina, but I'll read a short one.
A short one.
There is this. Perhaps I should read a couple of the Humpty Dumpty poems, the Trumpty Dumpty poems. This is the very first poem in the book. I'll read that, and I'll read the last one. Okay, because they go in different directions. Trumpty Dumpty wanted a wall to stir up a rabid political brawl. His Republican rivals, both feckless and stodgy, succumbed in the end to his rank demagogy. Dumpty's wall made no earthly sense, a boondoggle built at enormous expense. But he promised in speeches despotic and shrill he'd make certain that Mexico footed the bill. Trumpty Dumpty kept insisting. More and more citizens started resisting. Sadly, there won't be an end to this tale, at least until reasonable people prevail. That's how I open the book. And then about 2 or 3 poems from the end, here's part 4. There are 2 others in between that I won't read. And I wish you could see the illustration, but it's radio, so sadly you'll have to buy the book.
Sadly.
Trumpty Dumpty Part 4. Trumpty Dumpty wanted a barrier, broad as a wall, but preferably scarier. He wanted a fortress, forbidding and stout, to keep all those meddling journalists out. Dumpty detested each sentence they wrote. Presidential harassment was getting his goat. How could he counter their carping and slanders? That impregnable bulwark, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And if you see the illustration, it's a gigantic Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I did see that.
In the shape of a wall with Donald Trump, or Dumpty rather, sort of cringing behind her.
John Lithgow reading from his book, Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse. It was therapeutic to write this?
Yes, it made me feel like I was doing something. You asked me before about my political reticence. That came to an end, really, with the 2016 campaign, not to mention the November 7th election results. I just felt I had to do something.
Well, if you're worried about losing some of your audience as a result, you're certainly getting a lot of love from this one. This listener writes, Mr. Lithgow's range amazes me. He terrified me in Ricochet with Denzel Washington, as well as in Dexter. Plus, he's hilarious when he does comedy. But my favorite is his children's work. I love his Singing in the Bathtub album. I can't think of any other performers who have touched me so strongly in so many different ways. And Jesse writes, growing up, I always had an affinity for watching John Lithgow movies when I would stay homesick from school. Twilight Zone 2010 and Buckaroo Banzai were some of my favorites. I guess what it says is that I have always found him very comforting, and I still do. Carl writes, Third Rock was a great sitcom, but for movies, my favorite was Memphis Belle. Perfect casting of a functionary who was clueless to the surroundings and hard reality. And this listener says, you've played such a wide variety of roles, and you've made me laugh, cry, squirm, and shield my eyes. I'd like to know in which roles you felt the most sexy or powerful.
Oh, well, people don't come to me for sexy roles, but my ego has withstood that neglect. I don't know. Sexy role? Actually, I thought Roberta Muldoon was wonderfully sexy because she was such an amalgam, an interesting amalgam. It was a very sexy experience playing Roberta. It was my little insight into the thrill that a transvestite feels, you know. But, God, it's an almost embarrassing question. I just feel that I guess my crazy cockeyed energy is it's got a sort of sexual energy to it. Dick Solomon, of course, was a walking id, and just simply he was sort of all over the place. And there were marvelous moments of sexual abandon with Dick Solomon when he had absolutely no idea what he was doing or the effect he had. The first time he ever had sex with Dr. Albright, the hilarious Jane Curtin. It was a wonderful post-coital moment when we were lying in bed and, you know, there was a stiletto heel stuck to the wall and, you know, she was fast asleep and I said, oh, Dr. Albright, that was the most fabulous 15 seconds I've ever had, you know, that. But that, in a way, that's kind of me. I'm sort of all over the place sexually myself.
Well, let's hear from more listeners. Michael in Menlo Park, join us.
Hello, how are you?
Great.
Thank you so much for those readings. Those are awesome poems. Thank you. Listen, I know we only have seconds here. Can you tell me about one of your lesser mentioned, one of my favorite roles you've played with that Dr. Emilio Lizardo in Buckaroo Banzai?
I knew you were going to say that. Whenever anybody leads up like that, I know that they're going to ask me about Dr. Lizardo.
It's such a great role. It was so good. I loved it.
It was fantastic, and I had a wonderful time. Except for Third Rock, there's no job on which I laughed so hard and so long. In fact, if you look very carefully, there's a moment when you can see me losing it in the side of the screen. I completely break up. It's the moment when Big Booty gives me the finger. If you want to go back and have a close look. I recently played Rudy Giuliani on the Stephen Colbert Show just this past week. I don't know whether you saw that, Mina.
I did.
Oh, good.
I did.
I was very proud of it. But I said I would only do it if I could find my Buckaroo Banzai teeth. And by God, I found them. They painted them bright white, and I put them on for the first time in, about 40 years. And you can see them if you look on YouTube.
Yes. Well, if we're able to pull it up before the end of the hour, we will try to do that. Meantime, I'll get Anita from Marin into the conversation. Hi, Anita.
Hi. Thank you so much. And there's so much to love about you, Mr. Lico. No. And I thank you and I praise you and my hat's off.
Well, my gosh. I should do this more often, Mina.
Yes, you should. I want to rewind. I think it's maybe 2011 when you were the MC for the National Book Award. Was that the year, 2011, perhaps?
That would have been the year, yeah. It's the year my memoir was published, too.
Okay. So one of my favorite things about you is that what you said after Nikki Finney, who won the National Book Award for her book of poetry that year, Head Off and Split, as in fish, and you said after she gave her acceptance speech, which was itself a poem, you said that there...
Go on.
It was so amazing. And you said that there were other presenters to come for the evening, but that was the best acceptance speech you had ever heard for anything. And I just wanted to know what it must have been like to be in that room that night when she did that beautiful acceptance speech.
You know, I think I was just channeling the thoughts of everybody in the room. It was an extraordinary moment. You know, sometimes that happens on these occasions when just you're overwhelmed by emotion and by someone's extraordinary talent. And I remember that very distinctly. I'm delighted you remember it, too. Were you there in the room?
No, I was not there in the room. I heard about it later from a fellow storyteller. I'm a storyteller. And someone on the East Coast sent me an email saying, you've got to hear this, sister.
Yeah.
And so I went and I saw it on YouTube, and I recommended everybody else does. But the way that you captured the moment was beautiful.
Well, that is very, very kind of you. That was a happy memory for me, too. I have to tell you, I am a fantastic audience. I mean, I absolutely love the great work of other people. And that goes for acting and writing and reading poems out loud. I'm just wide open to have my heartstrings pulled. And I think, I'm not sure everybody is. I think you have to open yourself up to emotion. And I think I am in particular. I think most actors are because that's our business. And we love to receive as well as give.
Well, in this moment, let's hear that over-the-top performance of Rudy Giuliani located it.
Morning, Mina.
We want to play it for our audience now. This is John Lithgow as Rudy Giuliani in conversation with Stephen Colbert.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us. I haven't asked you anything yet.
I know, and your facts are all wrong, so shush it, zip it. And ask me a question.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, how do you respond to critics who say that you are traveling the world pushing debunked conspiracies as part of a scheme to help the president's re-election?
That's ridiculous, Stephen. I was simply bringing the American people the truth about the Bidens. And that's not all. I now have reason to believe that the 2016 election was not hacked by the Russians. It was hacked by Hunter Biden, who was actually a Men in Black-style alien being operated by a tiny Hillary Clinton in his neck.
A tiny Hillary Clinton in his neck. That is my guess. John Lithgow playing Rudy Giuliani. One of so many roles. I mean, I couldn't even fit on a sheet of paper all the roles that you have played. I do want to ask this question from one of our audience members. Eve writes, the most read children's book in my family was the remarkable Farkle McBride.
Oh, great.
After listening to this interview, I feel like you, John Lithgow, might be a little bit like Farkle. Do you think being unsatisfied with only pursuing the things you know best has kept you curious and growing all these years?
Well, what a wonderful question. You know, I'm not unsatisfied. I'm delighted by it. I have remained wide open and curious about pursuing other things. That's why I was very excited about writing this book, even though I was extremely intimidated by the notion. It's also why I launched myself into a sort of minor career, under-the-radar career as a children's entertainer and book writer and recording artist and even ballet dancer. I won't get into that. But I always tell young people when they ask me anything about getting going in the show business, in the theater profession or the film profession, I say the most important thing is to have something in your life, some creative aspirations that have nothing to do with being hired, that belong entirely to you. Write something, direct something, paint something, learn how to tap dance. Create a goal for yourself, and you'll never attain it. Somebody will hire you to act.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell our listeners that you will be in conversation with Michael Krasny tonight at 7:30 at the Osher Marin Jewish Community Center in San Rafael, so you'll get more of him there. Thank you, John Lithgow.
Thank you. This has been so fun, Mina.
I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.